when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Good Life Project is brought to you by Understood Explains, a podcast that's like a beacon for parents navigating the special education system. Hosted by Juliana Urtube, a special education expert, this season is all about individualized education plans, or IEPs. Juliana breaks down complex topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP in a way that's easy to grasp. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains about the difference between IEPs and 504 plans, and I was struck by the balance of empathy and practical advice. It's not just about understanding the system. It's about empowering parents and caregivers to advocate for their children, which is just so important. So I've known a number of people who've had to literally scramble to figure out how to advocate for their kids when the system seemed to just make it so hard to get the support that they need and deserve. So if you're a parent navigating this world, or even just wondering if it's right for your family, I encourage you to give Understood Explains a listen. Search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. It's like having a roadmap for a journey you didn't expect, making it a little less daunting.
It's actually like a little bit ironic. I think in the wellness community, you have so many entrepreneurs who are just so into it and they push and push and push. And it's like, wait, everyone's getting better off of what I'm doing, but what happened to me?
Sure. This week's guest is MindBodyGreen founder Jason Wacob. And I had a chance to actually sit down with Jason. We actually filmed this in the summer of 2013, and his episode aired in October, I believe, of 2013. And this was back when our format was primarily a video series. We had this amazing conversation. He was at a point where he had built this media and health company, and it was just starting to tip. It was just starting to get tremendous traction. In the last 2.5 years, the company has kind of exploded. The brand has grown incredibly. Their reach and their impact has grown into this global behemoth. The website alone gets something like 15 million unique visitors a month. They have all sorts of powerful educational programs. And it was really fun to be able to sit down with him again and really just kind of trace the last 2.5 years and see how the company grew and also how he has evolved and changed and how he's built community within his organization. He is also the author of a great new book called Wealth, and that's actually not spelled W-E-A-L-T-H. It's W-E-L-L-T-H. And it's really his lens on his guiding philosophy in building MindBodyGreen and on living a good life. So I thought it was a really fun moment to revisit the conversation with him and dive into that philosophy a bit and share in some of his stories. So really excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields. This is Good Life Project. You know, maybe it'd be kind of a fun jumping off point to just kind of like jump into the conversation that we were just having before. You know, you and I come from sort of like different business backgrounds, and then we're coming to it, and you walked into our HQ over here and saw a Grateful Dead sticker on the back of my computer and shared that you're sort of like a lifelong, you're like Deadhead. How many shows have you seen?
30-something.
Right. And then we were talking about a friend who wrote a book about sort of like the business built around Grateful Dead. And then you share the two books on your desk are Peter Thiel's 0-1 and that one. And I think it's kind of, and then you just dropped this thing that I want to pick up on, which is like you kind of had this feeling that you get like we're kind of moving. There was this really aggressive move towards this sort of hyper-aggressive, hyper-growth, technologically involved. And but maybe the pendulum is swinging back more towards like the Grateful Dead model.
I think it's a balance. I think, you know, growth is still important, especially being a mission-driven company. It's great to have a mission, but it's more important to have a mission that lots of people can touch and feel. And, but you know what I love about the debt is mission-inspired, community-driven, and very smart businessmen. And just, you know, you talk about brands, power of brands, very authentic, very strong brand. I was saying how I wrote my college thesis, how I got into Columbia, although I think the basketball helped there. You know,
and the fact that you're extraordinarily tall and extraordinarily talented.
I think that helped. Well, you know, about this idea of, I talked about the Grateful Dead and the thesis and the things I admired. The idea that it transcended, you know, race and class, the idea of, you know, community and the idea of authenticity.
Yeah. And I think we are really swinging back to that. My sense is that, and that's part of what you're trying to do with Mindbody Greens, part of what we're trying to do with Good Life Project is, you know, we both produce media, but bigger picture, we're both building community.
Sure.
You know, around a very, like the words you use were mission driven. And I think we're yearning for that, you know, there's been like this window of just sort of digital displacing human interaction. And yeah, I'm not a Luddite, neither are you. We both have technology like built into the core of what we're doing. But yeah, the idea of actually just building, you know, sort of unifying community is so powerful.
And I go back in history, you know, every great movement in the U.S. is largely from the ground up, you know, civil rights, ground up, not top down. You know, the top can help, so to speak, but at the end of the day, it's the ground, everything is from the ground up. And I think, you know, social media leaves us so connected digitally, but it also leaves a void physically. And I think, you know, being able to experience something digitally is powerful, but it's more powerful to be able to touch and feel it, especially with another human.
Yeah, completely agree with you there. I think digital is a great way to start. And then I think it often it's the initiating, like the inciting incident. And then when you meet that person face to face, it's like there's a level of rapport and comfort that's kind of already been established. So you kind of, you can go deeper faster. But I think it's important to still meet that person face to face if you can. You know, if you're in a part of the world where it's actually feasible. So we're hanging out right now and you're one of the few guests that is a returning guest.
I love it. I'm honored. Thank you.
and it was kind of fun too, because the first time we hung out, I was just looking back at the date, was on like the end of I think it was October 2013.
Yeah,
that was when we were still filming.
Yeah, right.
Because we actually filmed a couple months before that. So it was the summer. So about 2.5 years ago. And man, what a 2.5 years for you.
I know. I was thinking about that too. Like, where were we as a company? Where I was? What's the world? Everything?
Yeah. Can you just talk me through sort of this last 2.5 year window a little bit? Because it's been astonishing evolution.
Sure. It's been fun. It's been insane and fun at the same time. As a company, we've grown a lot. I think when we were maybe 3 or 4 million uniques.
Yeah. I think you were like right around 4 million.
And
by the way, just for those who may not have seen that first one. Jason runs this amazing company called Mindbody Green, which is, how would you describe it? Like, what's the short?
I always say we're a lifestyle media brand focused on helping you live your best life.
Right.
And to me, it falls, best life equals three pillars, Mindbody Green, and they're all connected, and I can explain why.
Got it. And we'll go into that. So when we were hanging out, you were pretty early in the journey. And I guess in theory, you could probably still argue that you are.
Early and late, but exactly. We're still early.
Right. And, you know, but you were like at this, I remember there was, you were like at a window where it almost felt like when we were hanging out, like there was this thing coming out of you, like we're like just starting to hit it. So take me sort of like to there and then like here.
From the business standpoint, that was a year of hyper growth that just happened. For a lot of media companies, this was the year 2013 to 14 when Upworthy became the fastest growing media company of all time. According to Fast Company, I think they went from 10 million uniques to 90 million.
Right. In like 3 months.
It was insane. A year and BuzzFeed. And so we went from essentially 2 million to 10, reached a high of 15. Now we're at that same level. And that's actually a great thing. And that's a deeper conversation. And so this happened with six people. And it happened when I still did all the social media. It happened really fast. And it was a situation where, you know, growth just happened and it was great. And the wheels didn't fall off the wagon, and have spent like the past year or two really setting process, structure, defining who we are as a brand, as a company, where do we want to go, who do we want to be. Yeah. Whereas that year was largely like, holy shit, it's like you're riding a wave, it's happening, let's go, we're on it, you know. And now it's settling back and really putting things in place to set us up for the future.
So. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting is when you have a year like that, you know, it's almost like it's the hockey stick moment that a lot of people talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
And it crushes a lot of people.
It is. It's good and bad, you know. And I think if the brand isn't tight, if the product isn't tight, you know, it can be the worst thing that can possibly happen to you. But I think when you do have a brand, when you do have a product, and you do have also the right people on the bus, you know, it's a great thing.
Yeah.
But there's still a catching up process and setting infrastructure and
yeah.
all that fun stuff.
How much of it do you think also had to do with the fact that there was a sort of defining mission, that this wasn't yep. just a technology company, it wasn't yep. just a media company, but there was like something bigger that yep. those six people could latch onto and say, like, we're working for something bigger.
Yep. Absolutely. So I think it was two things. One is, you know, Facebook decided to be kind of publishers, and that played a huge role in our growth. And then the second part of this is, you know, wellness is sort of seeped into the culture of America and across the world. And we were early on that.
Right.
And, you know, right time, right place, right headlines, right stories. And then, you know, touching on community, you know, community is something that is in our DNA. It started initially with me just reaching out to people, talking about meeting people individually. I did that and then just sort of steamrolled. And then community became a thing. It was not planned, just happened. And that's why it's authentic.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of big companies will say, you know, we want community. How do we do it? And I said, well,
let's install it.
Yeah, let's install it. Like, do they have it at Costco?
It's like, how much for a community?
Yeah. And it just, it's something that's important to us. It's one of our values. And it just, it's authentic.
So, I mean, but how do you cultivate that, especially in a hyper growth environment
sure.
where, like, what are the pillars of like trying to really make that happen in a way that's organic, well aligned? But at the same time, doesn't lock down control, because that's like the death knell for community.
Sure. It's a balance. You know, I think it always starts with the CEO to some degree. Yeah. And I think it's
top
something
down,
I
always.
Started and people, you know, I lead by example there. And it's one of our values. It's up on our wall at our office.
Yeah.
So it's always encouraging our team, you know, what are we doing? You know, how are we defining community? What does that look like for you? Like, community is not transactional. Community, you know, how can we support our community? What does that look like? It's something we talk about every day. It's important. And I think it'll evolve. And it's, you know, and it's one thing too, I think, when you're running a company, is to like put something on the wall or put a mission statement or define your culture. But it's another thing, like, what does that look like in a daily basis?
Right. It's like, how do you actually live that?
Yeah. And I think part of it's personnel and hiring the right people. And I think part of it, you know, it's a lot of variables. And I think every company struggles with that.
Yeah, no doubt. So I'm going to corner you. How do you define community?
It's a couple things. So I look at community in terms of the contributors who write for us or we produce content with, who we celebrate. And I think they're the community people who love the site, read the site, watch the site. So people who, I would define it as people who are in the mind, body, green world. Mm. And for us, it's important to have that relationship not be just transactional.
So what do you mean? What do you
transactional break it down, as in, but... so like for a contributor, is it just simply you're writing a post and there's an exchange and that's it?
Right.
To me, that's not a great relationship. A great relationship is, what are you working on? And it's hard to do. It is a challenge at scale, but, you know, it can be done. It's having a conversation. It's supporting them. It's, are you working on a book? Where does your brand want to be? How can we help you? It's a back and forth. It's inviting people to the office. It's not just a transactional relationship where you write, you get followers, you get email subscribers, you get visibility. It's a give and take. And I think that's important. And if you're great, you know, we put you in a video course or a class and it's revenue sharing and that's great. But, you know, what it's talking to people, it's cultivating talent. It's more than just a transaction where you do this and I do that. And then we wipe our hands and call it a day.
Yeah. And I love that because it's a long-term investment.
Yep.
You know, and it elevates your burden.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it elevates everybody's possibility.
Yeah.
You know, so there's the benefit is potentially exponential, even though it's going to take more investment and work for you.
Sure. It's just, to me, it's one of these things where it's just like the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Like,
right, deep down.
And I think the right thing to do is often like good business for the most part. It's just the right thing to do, you know, so.
which kind of circles back to like the Grateful Dead.
Sure.
Right? I mean, one of the things that you were sharing with me before we jumped on the mic was, you know, how you could show up at a concert and people were for like every walk of life,
mm-hmm.
yet they were unified around sort of like the love of the music.
Mm-hmm.
But also one of the things that you were talking about was, you know, there's a little bit of like a clicky effect of like the people who are early into the community.
Sure.
For one particular purpose.
Sure.
And then like the newbies are coming yep. in and kind of, where very often like the early people are like, well, they don't really get what this is really about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Have you experienced that at all in sort of like the way that you're building?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, yeah. And I was one of those Grateful Dead snobs and yeah. fish snobs in the early days. But yeah, absolutely. I think you see that a lot in the wellness community now. It's seeped into the mainstream in a lot of ways. And it's one of these things where people often view others as you're not hardcore enough. And you know, it can quickly become a Portlandia episode.
Mm.
But and that's something we're careful about. And, you know, we're also big now, too. We're not just a small, you know, quote unquote blog. Like, right. I really think we're a lifestyle media company. We offer other products besides content. And so how do you maintain that? How do you maintain scale and being big, but at the same time being authentic and reaching a broader audience without quote unquote selling out?
So. Yeah, and welcoming people in and saying, well, maybe like the people that we're calling sellouts, like what's the value that they're seeing that
right.
maybe actually we should be expanding our lens to see too,
mm-hmm.
rather than just holding on to like this is the orthodoxy and this is the way that it has to be as it perpetuates through every ripple of the circle.
Sure.
But that's not easy to do, man.
No, I think it's something we talk about a lot. And I think with content, we're actively doing this. And I think we're doing a good job is, you know, it's all levels. So, you know, we have the listicle where it's going to suck in a newbie, but then we're doing long form. And that's attractive to someone who's been around the block for, you know, 10 years. Or this is old for them. And we've got video courses and events where we can go deeper. So it doesn't matter what level you're at. We can grow with you as you grow within wellness. So.
Yeah. You brought up long form.
Sure.
It's interesting to me because, you know, we do long form content on this podcast.
Yeah.
And when we were doing video, you know, back mm-hmm. in the day, we were blasted for doing hour long videos. You know, people are like, this will never work. You know, nobody has the attention span.
Right.
Nobody wants long form content. And I was always thinking to myself, but I do. And I can't imagine I'm the only person out there. And as I'm like a zag person and I'm like seeing everybody go short. And I'm like, so I want to be the long person.
Yep.
Are you exploring that more? And what are you finding people's relationship to long form?
You need both.
Yeah.
I think you need both. I think if you're really engaged, you want long form. You want more.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, especially in personal growth and health and wellness, it's when you're in. You can't get enough.
No.
You know, I want to go deeper. Give me more. You know, sure, that listicle or that real short piece is great when I'm on my phone on the go, but at night or whatever the appropriate time to digest the content is, like, you want to go deeper. I want to go deeper. And lots of people do. And we find that actually with Mind Body Green, there's a direct correlation between length of time on page and length of article.
Hmm. Interesting.
So people want the long stuff. It's got to be good.
Yeah, of course.
But there's an appetite for it.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of reminds me back in the day when I was actually learning to copyright.
Yeah.
And one of the classic questions was, you know, and for those who don't know what copywriting is, it's sort of like, you know, when anything that you see written anywhere online, or if you got something in the mail where it's designed to interest you and then potentially sell you something, that's it. And
you're quite good at that.
Thanks, man. And I knew some of the A-list copywriters, and, you know, some of them even took me under their wing. And these guys would create what were even back then called magalogs, where it was like literally a 60-page sort of like magazine piece, which was functionally a 60-page sales letter that you would get in the mail. They would literally mail these to millions of people. And there was this ongoing conversation, which is like, how long is too long?
Right.
And the answer that effectively I got back from the best people in the world is, as long as you need to get the job done and not a word longer.
Exactly.
And that could be really long.
Exactly. It's funny, you know, for our Revitalize event, which is a live stream event, and we do
Tucson
the past 2 years. We do standalone talks that are, you know, the TED style where it's one person and you're up there. And we work with a speaker coach on that, and she communicated the same thing. People would say, well, how long? And she would say, as long as it takes you to communicate one idea very strongly. If it takes 8 minutes, great, but it shouldn't take longer than 22. If it takes longer than 22, you get a problem.
which is like every keynote speaker here just recoiled.
Oh, it's, like, I've learned so much about that. Yeah, it's, yeah.
Well, it's funny too, because I speak. I think you do some speaking as well. So, and the typical keynote is generally 45 minutes to an hour.
Too long.
And, but you wonder, so here's my question. Like, is that a function, is that sort of like the analog to a 250-page book? Where it's a, right. it's more a function of the industry says for us to kind of like sell it for X and pay you X, it needs to be X minutes long or X pages long.
I think so.
You kind of make it so.
Right. I think so. And I think the way to do it, which I'm sure you do, it's got to be a performance less than a script. It's,
yeah.
you know, cue the laugh and I go here and that. And it's a performance versus a presentation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I resisted that fiercely for a really long time because I was just like, I can't. But like, their performing is not. It's inauthentic. Was the
right.
the line in my head. And then a conversation with a friend of mine who trained speakers and who's also a former like TV actor and and who was phenomenal on stage. And he's like, no, it is. He's like, the best people in the world, with rare exception, are 100% scripted and 100% staged.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you know, when you see somebody kind of like scratching their head and looking off to like to the top, you know, with their eyes up to the right and then walking to this point in the stage and then saying something spontaneous, which just boom, makes you weep. It's like every word and every moment and every step is scripted.
Yeah.
And but he said the difference is that if you choose to go that route, then you should literally practice that for months and months and months until it becomes – the script becomes so much just automatic mm-hmm. that it's so embodied that you can actually then really let go and kind of come back into yourself and loosen up, or else everything feels like just kind of like
right. fake. I think it's almost like a metaphor for life. Like anything, you have to work your ass off and get it down and then be open to possibility. And it's that combination of push and pull. And I think most people are just used to one or the other, where it's just a constant push, no room for quote unquote universe, and then the other people are just open to everything and they're not prepared.
Yeah.
and it's like this balance I think that the self-help world struggles with.
Yeah. So when you speak, what's your approach to that?
It depends what the venue, you know, who the audience is, and you know, I always say speak to the audience. Like if I'm speaking at a trade event for advertisers, that's going to be different than speaking to consumers. And just, I think the biggest thing is know your audience. Like literally I was on a panel once for an Advertising Week panel, and the person next to me said she hated advertising. and I'm like, that know the audience, you
right.
know, like she hated advertising and we'd never do print ad. And it's like, just pretend to know the
right
like know the audience. You don't have to love advertising, but there was probably a little more tactful way to say that. So I feel bad because everyone, you know, comes from a big brand, well-respected, really powerful brand, and I could see the look on the faces in the room, like, but know the audience. Always know the audience.
Yeah, no, that's a huge lesson. So let's kind of like circle back a little bit. I'm curious also, and you have this kind of really cool new book out. I want to touch down on some of the ideas in
sure.
it as well. But I want to come a little bit full circle on your sort of like last 2.5 year journey. So we've seen like the company experience tremendous growth. And mm-hmm. one of the things you also just kind of dripped out is you shot up to 15, then back to 10. Now you stabilize at 15.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's a really good thing to
yes.
sort of like have that boom, boom, boom.
Yep.
Why?
So what Facebook giveth, Facebook can take it away. and so
heard from so many people.
Yeah. And so, you know, my background, I was a trader, and, you know, I believe in everything works until it doesn't work. So when we grew, that growth spurt happened, Facebook represented 70% of our traffic.
Wow.
Which was great, but
right.
back of my mind
completely
saying, this is not going to last forever. And I don't want to be completely reliant on any one thing for anything in business. And so spent the last 2 years focused on diversifying traffic, what's quality traffic versus quantity. We also have an e-commerce component, like what really drives that. So I've spent the past 2 years diversifying, you know, and 15 was a little bit of an aberration. Like we essentially went to 12. We had one 15 month, but we've been in this range. And so we went from Facebook representing 70% of our traffic to now it's down to 35%.
Hmm.
It's a lot healthier and we've stabilized. And now more of our traffic is email, better relationship. You control that relationship.
Right.
You know, people like it's direct relationship. It's healthier. And so we're in a much better place rather than depending on one source of traffic. So Upworthy is now, I think, at like 16 or 17 million uniques.
Oh, wow. They dropped
to 90 to, yeah.
back down. Huh.
Yeah. And so there's this direction we're going to. Like, I don't believe in traffic for the sake of traffic.
Yeah.
You know, I believe in healthy traffic. I believe, you know, we're a lifestyle company. We have a commerce component. Like, for us to succeed, you know, I don't want, you know, sure, I love traffic, but we don't need to get to 50 million or 100 million uniques to really succeed. We need a really strong group of people who believe in Mind, Body, Green and follow us, right. you know, as we get into other more commerce and events and who are part of the tribe. Like, I want a tribe, not just
traffic.
Yeah, yeah. It's a balance. You know, you need traffic, you need scale. We have that. But like, if we're 10 or 12 or 20, it doesn't really matter for, you know.
Yeah.
For one, it matters. You know, you don't have scale,
right.
problem. But yeah. once you have it, it's, you know, so.
Yeah. It's also got to be, you know, because you've also scaled up your staff a lot from the
sure.
six people when we were hanging
sure.
out. Where are you at now, about?
30.
Right. So that's, you know, a 5X
yep.
on the size of your, you know, the people who work there. And that sort of like hyper growth combined with like kind of like a whiplash, you know, like mm-hmm. pinball effect has
yep.
got to be just brutally hard psychologically on the people who are in there every day. Like,
yeah, a lot of people came on later, and it's been a process of defining the brand, defining the culture, finding the right people who work out, you know, in the
yeah.
culture. And we've had hits and misses with people. You know, hiring's very hard. I think now we're quite good at it. But in the beginning, you know, we weren't so good at it.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people struggle with that.
What do you think was the turning point there?
I think you start to see, like, what types of people work and what don't work. And, you know, like, qualities start to stick out. And like certain things come to the forefront, and then you just get better at interviewing. You know what questions to ask. And like
yeah.
you also have, you can go back on time when you've seen little red flags and you just, you needed to make the hire. So you made it, and then it bit you in the ass, and having a lot tighter process. And now I think we're quite,
yeah.
it takes a while. And I think every company struggles with that.
Yeah, no doubt.
Until you get it.
Is there one like overriding thing that you look for in somebody that you're going to bring into your family?
Well, I think it's a couple. One is, I think, passion for health and wellness.
Mm.
I think passion can't be taught. I think it's super important. I think we'll never be as good as we could be if we're not passionate and not the top of our game. And I do think if you're passionate about health and wellness, we're the best media company to work for. So I think that's people who work hard too. You know, I think work ethic is one of those things. It's hard to really teach.
Yeah.
You know, I always like hiring athletes. Ex-athletes.
Oh, no kidding.
Know. Well, the things you show up on time, little things.
Right.
You tend to work hard. You tend to be competitive. Things that are instilled in me, but
right.
they're
yeah.
hard to teach later in life. You know, and I do think 80%, there was a great article I read in Harvard Business Review about hiring the other day about like a fast food chain in the South that's like growing super rapidly and has like very low turnover. It's insane. They hire for attitude first.
Mm.
And then they can teach the skill.
Train the aptitude.
Yeah. So
yeah.
like, are you passionate? Do you work hard? If you have a brain, like we can work with you.
Yeah. So. I think that's such a powerful way to do it. But like you said, a lot of times in the beginning, there's like one specific skill set that you just have to have today. So sometimes you overlook that
right.
just to get that, you know, competency installed. But
yeah.
over time, it always comes back at you.
Yeah. And I think a lot of companies, I think it's like, it's defining your culture, seeing yeah. patterns. And then once you have it and it's tight, like now I think we're getting phenomenal people. Like
that's awesome.
It's great. And I also think people are really interested in health and wellness right now and like leaving other careers. They want to work. There is this like, you know, movement of wealth. You know, it's like people want to work for a company that, you know, they
values
share values.
Us, yeah.
Exactly.
So. No doubt. I think it's so important. Do I remember you working with your wife?
Yeah, she works with us.
Full
yeah.
time.
Yeah, every day.
Right. And that
and
was,
we live together too.
That, it's like you and me both. It's so funny because we have, I mean, you know, we love being around each other
yeah.
all day. And you know, sometimes we have to like, you know, remember, turn off the work conversation
at
home
problem.
At night.
Yep, same problem.
You know, a number of people have asked us like, how is that even possible that... And we're like,
right.
you know, it's not right for everybody.
No, it's not.
But we have the same values. We, you know, really complementary skill sets.
Yep.
And we just genuinely love being around each other.
Yep.
So it works really well for us.
Yeah. We're in the same boat.
Yeah.
But we have the same problem shutting it off.
Yeah. I mean, that is the single biggest challenge.
Last word comment. We use that line all the time.
Really?
Okay. Last word comment. I'm like, I don't, last word comment.
That's got to be like a Slack, like a hashtag on our Slack.
Oh, God. Yeah. Last word comment.
Like just for the entire like team, just like hashtag last word comment. Okay. We're all done for
yes.
the day. Yeah. But that is, I mean, that is it. I mean, you know, we're sitting here in an office and we built our own studio, which is literally, you know, like an 8-minute walk from our home. And part of the reason we did it was to create a physical,
yeah,
you know, a physically different space where we can kind of like close the door on the office,
mm-hmm.
walk back, you know, together and kind of like use that to maybe just start to transition into a different state of mind, a different conversation.
Yep.
So let's kind of segue into what you're working on now. You have a book out called Wealth, spelled
W-E-L-L-T-H.
Right. Why that spelling?
You know, it just sort of happened. You know, this idea, I saw the word a little bit here and there, but this idea, you know, it's part of my personal journey where wealth is about health.
Mm.
Sort of a play on that word and really loved it and just decided to go for it.
Yeah. So. And which is funny too, because before you started Mind Body Green, you come out of a, you know, like a trading background. So you were really like, you're working with money every day mm-hmm. on a large scale. So it's an interesting sort of like redefinition or reframe.
Yep.
I want to bounce through some of the ideas, and there are some of the common ones that I'm going to kind of avoid actually, but
sure.
One of the things that you talk about is work. You actually tell the story of your uncle.
Yeah.
Can you share that?
So in the book, I talk about my uncle. It's my only uncle. My father was an only child. My mother just had one sibling. And so my uncle, this guy who worked his ass off for 40, I think he's 71 or 72 now, like his whole life, just really the consummate worker, was a banker, was an entrepreneur for a while, had a deli in like the fashion district in the 80s when New York wasn't so fun,
mm-hmm.
you know, just worked and worked and worked, never really, you know, always put family first, always would spend on family, never really spent on himself, not because he's really giving guy, you know, finally gets to retirement. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, he finds out he's got stomach cancer. You know, it's just like this, what the hell was I doing? You know, climbing the ladder and, you know, for a few extra bucks, which is great, you know, supporting the family. But like, to talk about devastating, you work and work and work. And then now I've got my retirement is chemo, you know, so.
And I think the paradigm that so many of us live by is, you know, you work for retirement.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I'll live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thankfully, you know, like at sure. least from what I know, and you probably actually wrote the book about a year before, but
yep. Yeah,
the way the story is left is that, you know, he's good.
He's got like a little left, but yeah. like it's negligible, and he's good.
Yeah.
He's good.
But it's gotta be a huge wake up call.
You know? Yeah.
When that happens to you and you're, you know, in your early 70s,
sure.
you know, there's, I'm sure, you know, you think things through also, but for you to also, well, I guess you saw it where you had already had your own wake up call.
I did. For me, it was 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, and I think also, too, I worked, you know, I didn't come from money and always wanted money and, you know, pay off my school debt and just I was drawn to money. And then finally made money as a trader, and my life, a relationship was sort of falling apart. And all of a sudden, it was such a defining point. And on one hand, I finally have all this money. And the other hand, I've got a relationship completely falling apart and I'm miserable. So talk about, you know, contrast. To me, it was a big wake up, like money's not happiness here.
Mm.
And then things sort of went from there.
Yeah. So, I mean, at this point, what's your lens? Why do you work?
I love what I do. You know, I believe in this idea of wealth. I believe in Mind Body Green. I believe in helping people. I'm passionate about what I do. I love that I get to meet all these amazing people. I love that I get to sit here with you. You know, I love that we're, you know, the letters we get, the people we touch, like that's awesome. I love it. But the challenge I have now is, you know, I think I love what I do so much. I work all the time.
Yeah.
So on the flip side, like I don't want to be the guy, and I have to be careful about this, where I work so much where I'm always thinking about what's the next vacation I could go to, because it's just a shorter version of that longer story where I'm working and working. How do you create a life where you're not always looking forward to the next vacation?
Yeah.
even though vacations are still important. But
yeah, I wonder also, and I wonder if it sounds like this might be something that spins in your head too, but you know, when you actually do something that you do enjoy so immersively,
mm-hmm.
whether, you know, that can take you down a rabbit hole.
Absolutely.
The same way like an artist just loves
yep.
to paint
yep.
and you start to just ignore, you know, all the other parts of your life that are, you also like kind of forget.
Sure.
I really enjoy that. Like, I love working out. I love my relationship.
Sure.
I love, so it's almost like you need people or triggers to pull you back out.
Yeah, I absolutely. I think my wife is good at that with me. I think I find time to meditate. I find time. My yoga practice has evolved. I don't go to the studio like 4 or 5 days a week anymore. Now it's a home practice and it's 2 or 3 days a week, but it's something. And I think you have to find time. And it's actually like a little bit ironic. I think in the wellness community, you have so many entrepreneurs who are just so into it and they push and push and push. And it's like, wait, everyone's getting better off of what I'm doing, but what happened to me?
Yeah.
So that's something I don't ignore, and I've almost gone down that path where I'm like, whoa, like I need to myself here.
Same thing on my side. I've had to catch myself
yeah.
many, many, many times. When like back in the day when I actually ran a yoga studio. Yeah,
all this yoga is making me sick.
Right, exactly. but this was a really big issue because there was a window of time where I ran a yoga studio. We were training yoga teachers, and one of the first things that we saw happening on a pretty consistent basis, and it wasn't just, you know, like our teachers, it was just teachers all over the place, was that the busier you got as a teacher, so many teachers started to walk away from their practice.
Yep.
And yep. I think it was a combination of the fact that you're just getting busier, a combination of the fact that I sometimes like would think that there was this psychology where if you had 2 private clients and taught 3 classes in a day, at the end of the day, you kind of felt like you had practiced because
mm-hmm.
you'd been in the room through like 3 classes and like working with 2 privates. But in fact, you know, you had really emptied your system rather than filled it the way that practice, your own personal practice would.
Right.
So we actually, when we were training teachers, we instituted what we called our MDRs, like your minimum daily requirements.
Oh, that's great.
And we told teachers, we're like, look, it doesn't matter what happens. When you get to the end of your day, you cannot go to sleep. Like, do not rest your head on the pillow unless you've done, you know, like this, this, and this.
Right.
You know, 15-minute really basic practice, a little bit of pranayama and a little bit of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not optimal, but at least it's like a maintenance dose.
Exactly.
You know, and because we found that so many people, the busier you got, the more you started to leave your practice, and it's just self-destructive.
Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting that you picked up on that as well.
I think everyone has that challenge.
Yeah. So the one of the interesting things that you also you explore with the idea of work, and this was in the context of Colleen, of your wife, was this idea of thinking 3 steps ahead.
Sure, yeah.
Which I thought was kind of interesting because it's also – there's this really interesting tension between being present now but also being intelligent about what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a little bit about
this.
Yeah,
I think there are a lot of people out there who – necessarily aren't that happy in their current career and want to make a change. They want to do it and they can't do it quick enough and they're ready to do a 180 really fast. And I think that's very hard to do. A lot of people can't do that.
And I think especially later as you get older,
it gets harder and harder. When you're younger, you
have a lot of responsibility.
So it's this idea of thinking 3 moves ahead. And I use Colleen as an example in the book. Colleen also passionate about wellness, and her background, she went to Stanford and then worked in retail, you know, worked at Old Navy and Banana Republic at Gap, and then wanted to get out of the fashion box, so to speak, wanted to get more closer to me before we could actually hire her. And so she took a job at Walmart. And once she took the job at Walmart, it became, oh, wait, Colleen's not in retail. Colleen works for Walmart, the biggest retailer in the world. She's not in this fashion world anymore. So it got her out of the fashion box. Then at Walmart, she took a job at Amazon. And then instead of being, I work in retail, oh, I work for the biggest e-commerce player in the world. And then that led her to, she worked at Organic Avenue, where Organic Avenue looked at her and said, oh, wait, we're looking to scale. We've got someone who's worked for the biggest e-commerce player in the world, the biggest retailer in the world. So it allowed her to get to her passion, but it took, and then that led her to MindBodyGreen, where she had, you know, experience in e-com, in branding, in wellness, and then just fit perfectly for me. And it's that notion of sometimes you have to take steps to position yourself it's very hard to just do overnight. When you're younger, I think a little easier, but still difficult.
Yeah, and I think there's also this really interesting tension because we tend to – we're in a now culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's like, why can't I just make a massive leap to this?
Sure.
You know, and why can't it just happen instantly? And I think there's a large expectation of, well, I can and I should be able to.
Yeah.
And sometimes – so I think the idea of looking three steps ahead and kind of mapping it out and saying, well, you know, there's – there may be a series of, you know, like smaller steps and moves. You know,
sure.
It's almost like, yeah, it's chess versus checkers, right?
Sure.
It's kind of thinking, okay, like the greatest chess players, like they see the board, you know, like 10 moves out.
Yeah. And sometimes you don't even have to see it. You just got to start moving. You
right.
know, it's like, I didn't become a successful entrepreneur. It took 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's not something, you know, I think people read a lot about, you know, the Facebooks and the Twitters of the world or Uber. And you know, the reality is that's not, that doesn't really happen that often.
Yeah. That's why they call them unicorns.
Exactly. Exactly.
And more and more, I think we're going to see a lot of the unicorns losing their horns. So
I agree.
Yeah. But I love the, I'm actually glad you sort of like offered that reframe too, because there is a big difference between thinking three steps ahead and just taking the first step.
Exactly.
Which, you know, a lot of people will just get up into their heads and try and like map out what those steps are going to be. But very often it'll take three steps, but you won't actually know.
Exactly.
You know, you take the first one and that's what reveals the second one, which reveals the third one, which
exactly.
then reveals like the place you actually want to end
yep.
up. Was there a moment where both you and Colleen knew that like you both wanted, she wanted to be at MindBodyGreen, you wanted to be at MindBodyGreen, you would love to have had her there.
Sure.
But it was like, God, we didn't want to make this happen, but there's really like, the spot is not there for what you do.
Sure. Or just in general, you know, yeah. I think Colleen always wanted to be there. Except in the beginning, it was me for almost 3 years, no salary.
Right.
Colleen had to work, you know, Colleen was very understanding and supportive. It was me full time, all in, no salary. My co-founders, Tim and Carver, kept their day job and were working nights and weekends. So they're literally And Colleen would write guest posts. She would help with that. She would do anything he could. I think secretly yeah. always wanted to be there. And then in 2013, it worked out. She was leaving Organic Avenue. We needed help with ad sales. And it was, this isn't your background, but you're
close
the best
enough.
Available. Close
right,
enough.
Yeah.
And like, I know you're going to be great. You're like the best available player, so to speak. Like,
right.
let's go. And she's been great. And so, yeah.
Yeah. That's,
around that that's
awesome. One of the other things that you talk about that I found interesting was belief, this idea of
sure.
believing. And that's, it really resonates with me because one of the things that I've come to realize more and more what Good Life Project is about is inspiring possibility. I've really come to believe that one of the biggest failures and simultaneously the flip side is unlock keys for people going out there and actually building the lives that they want is mm-hmm. believing it's possible.
Sure.
Take me into why you felt this was important to explore.
I think so many people don't believe.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a simple, it's simple, but it's hard. And I think it's very easy to believe when everything is great. I think it's yeah. very difficult. What's that great line? Something like faith is believing without seeing.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard, but I think there's, you know, I think what was it like Steve Jobs or I read this recently and I think it's so true. It's like, we're all just people. I think some are smarter, some aren't as smart, but for the most part, what separates people who are extremely happy or successful in their definition. I think part of it is, you know, I think it's belief and attitude and work. You know, it's this idea that, you know, if you can't believe, you know, if you don't believe anything's going to happen, it's just not going to happen. You know, we're in a world where I think anything is possible to some degree. But if you don't believe it's possible, then probably not going to be possible.
Yeah. I mean, what was that? The big Steve Jobs novel, what do they call it? Like his zone of, it wasn't delusion, but it was like.
Oh yeah. Yes. I know exactly what you're talking about.
The
distortion reality
yeah, yeah.
field
Rrr.
Where he would just convince everyone.
Right. It's like, you know, he would sit there and say like people like, I can't do that. I'm
yeah.
like, I'm not capable. I don't have that. Like it's,
it
or it's
three
not
months.
Possible.
No, it's 3 weeks.
Right. And I think that was one of his geniuses is
right.
that he had the ability to convince people that the impossible was possible. And
right.
once they believed it, it kind of like wires your brain to
sure.
start to just figure out ways to make it happen that
Absolutely.
Wouldn't, where your brain wouldn't have worked on that level.
What was it, the 4-minute mile?
Famous Roger Bannister.
Yes, and then boom, boom, and the next thing you know, everyone's doing it.
Yeah, and I think it is. It's something that's that tends to be explored in a somewhat metaphysical level, but yes, I think it's much more basic than that.
I do.
You know, in fact, you kind of break it into sort of like three phases.
Yeah. And I think it's like believe in seeing and doing. It's like this idea of, you know, believing you can do it and then seeing yourself doing it.
Yeah.
And then also doing. And I like this idea of, you know, the small wins.
Yeah.
You know, you got to start off small. Small wins bring confidence. You can focus on bigger things. But like simple things. Like in the book, I talk about like this idea of like, you know, you want to eat healthier. You want to maybe lose weight, you know. Focus on like one meal a day or two, you know, you're going to have a salad. What does a salad look like? Like feel it, taste it, you know, and move forward from there. Then you've knocked it out for this day and you feel good about that. Then you build off of that, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think it's also probably easier to believe, well, I can eat a salad today rather than I can eat a salad for life.
Right. Exactly. Right.
You know, it's kind of like, are you familiar with BJ Fogg's work?
Yeah.
Yeah. So his whole thing is like, he's like, you know, there's behavior. I think he sort of splits behaviors into three different things. One is what he calls a dot, which is like, I'm going to do it one time. I'm going to eat a salad today.
Right.
Like that's the easiest thing to motivate yourself to do. And then next is what he calls a span, which is like, I'm going to eat a salad every day for 30 days. Still doable, but it gets a lot harder, you know, to keep the level of motivation ability up for that. And then the final, I can't remember what the final one is, but it's basically, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. It's nearly impossible for somebody to commit to that. But if they commit to the smaller things, it just starts to roll over and become for life or become the span and then for life.
And it builds confidence, and confidence is everything in a lot of ways.
Yeah. You know, and when you validate that it's actually possible through your own, like you said, like chunking it down, your own little, like little iterations and experiments. You're like, oh, wait a minute. You know, like your own experience is validating your belief.
And I think that's really powerful in life when you can draw back on things when, you know, when adversity sets in, you can draw back to specific moments. Well, you know, this happened and I was okay. And I moved on and I did it. And having that in your bag, so to speak, to go back to is really powerful versus having nothing when you can't draw back on personal experience and you're just sort of feeling screwed.
I agree. I think it's huge. Did any of that come out of your experience sort of as an athlete? I'm curious.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of it must have, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, in retrospect, I learned more about life from playing basketball than anything I ever learned in Columbia or in learning. I think some of my greatest life lessons came from playing basketball.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny too, because now two of the first things that are cut from education now are physical education and art. And, you know, you look back and the ancient scholars all knew that there was pretty much no such thing as a scholar. There were scholar athletes. Like they understood the relationship between athletics and scholarship and also just movement and exercise and how it affects your mind and body. And that's also one of the things that you explore is the fact that, you know, there's this great line that you have. It was like the body
doesn't wag the mind. The mind wags the body.
Right. Which is counterintuitive for a lot of people, but I think the science is really there now.
Yeah. It's catching up. You know, I think a lot of people would agree that stress is very real and stress affects you physically. That stress is, you know, I always say too, like you can't really eliminate stress. You just have to learn to deal with it. And I think stress is debilitating. It manifests itself in different ways for different people. I say in the book, I think stress hits you where you're weak physically. And, you know, for lack of a cliche, you know, stress is everything. And to your point, I think science is catching up in a big way. You talk to anyone who's probably not feeling well or experiencing a serious illness, you know, you start talking to them. You know, it's like Lisa Rankin, you know, our friend, Mind Over Medicine. People start to open up their mouths and stress pouring out. I think science is catching up in a big way there.
Yeah. Stress hits you where you're physically weakest. Take me a little more into that.
So for me, I personally have experienced that where, you know, I talk about in the book, in my journey, I came to this, I had excruciating back pain. I had two extruded discs and I'm pressing on my sciatic nerve and my back was weak from an old basketball injury combined with flying and stress. And in the spiritual level, I always thought it was very interesting because it was the root chakra and the root chakra it's around money worries around that time. My money was very, very tight and not abundant, so to speak. And that was sort of a spiritual awakening where like, whoa, like all, you know, it's always a spiritual person, but when it happens to you, it sort of really sinks in. Mm. So I think that, you know, became very clear. And then, you know, I had a parasite a couple years later. And anytime I was stressed, the stomach would flare. It came and then I got over it and my stomach's fine now. And like, but there was definitely patterns. Like when stress hit, it would go back to the back when the back was weak. When stress hit with the parasite, it'd go back to the stomach. I would notice it.
Mm. It's amazing how our body works that way.
Yeah. It's one of these things like, oh yeah, mind, yeah. Body, one. And so, when you start to experience it, you're like, yeah. Holy shit.
Same on this side. I mean, I have old injuries and I know that when I'm really under stress, you know, like I had a shoulder twice reconstructed. I'm like, why is my shoulder hurting? Because there's nothing that I did to my shoulder, but you're like, that's where it goes. It's weird the way we're wired like that. One of the other things that you explored, which I thought was kind of interesting, is love.
Yeah.
Why? Like where does this fit into your sort of paradigm?
Well, you know, I always think love is interesting because you're either looking for love or you're in love. And I think a lot of people want to improve their love life, improve their relationship. And I also think there, you know, love is also not enough too. I think love is important, but I think there are, you know, I talk about this idea of soulmates and there are different types of soulmates you know, in the book, I say that there's the kind of soulmate and Gary Zukav in Seed of the Soul talks about this idea of the soulmates who come and help pick, you know, get you from A to B. And they're there for very specific amounts of time. And soulmates is also like a very debatable thing. Like some people will say like, that's it. You know, that's the end note. So I think there's that type of soulmate. And I think there's also the forever soulmate. Something that I think as a culture, you know, I think we yearn for that. I think personally, it's what I believe. And it's this idea that there is someone out there for you. And I talk about my own relationships that have worked and not worked and lessons I've learned there.
It's interesting that you sort of like identify that there's like a transitional soulmate to get you from point A to point B. But like they're that person for this moment or for this journey. Yeah. And then there's sort of like the overarching. I need to sort of like explore that a little bit more in my mind. It's I haven't thought about it that way. I was going to say that I was revisiting recently the longest running ever study on that sort of like, I can't remember the name of it, the Harvard study on men, where they sort of tracked these, like it's a 75 year long study where they tracked Harvard grads and then sort of like people from like the area at that time. And literally they were reporting in on a regular basis for now something like 7 decades and looking at every aspect of their life to try and key in on like what were the things that, you know, allowed people to live good lives, to be happy.
Right.
And like the big emergence, one of the big, big things is like across the board, love.
Yeah. And it's Sue Johnson, who's Dr. Sue Johnson, who's actually in the book, talks about this a lot. You know, she always says that the science is there, we're mammals. We depend on one another. You know, we need love. We need relationships. We are not meant to be flying solo. She believes that wholeheartedly. Some people disagree, but she makes a pretty powerful point.
Yeah.
But I also think, I'll add one thing. Okay. I don't think you need someone. I think there's a difference.
Okay,
you don't
take me there.
Need someone.
Because I'm glad you said it, because there are going to be people listening to this saying, like, I'm not in that relationship now, so I can't live a good life.
Well, I'm also saying that's what Sue Johnson says. Right. Like, I also believe wholeheartedly you have to be personally fulfilled. You cannot depend on someone else for your happiness. And something else I'll talk about in the book. Like, you need to be fulfilled. You need to be happy. You cannot depend. Someone else will not bring you fulfillment. Someone else, a partner, can bring you more happiness and more joy. But if you cannot look to someone else to help fulfill you, that is a recipe for disaster. So it's a bonus.
So when Tom Cruise looks at Renee Zellweger and says, "You complete me."
Jerry Maguire.
Right, Jerry Maguire. That's not entirely healthy.
No, it's not. It's this idea of like, you know, exactly. You know, I think when you find the right partner, it's, you know, I say this in the book, it's 1-on-1 = 3, not 1-on-1 = 1.5 or 2. No. And I think, you know, as individuals, I think you need to be in a place where you are happy and fulfilled.
Yeah.
And someone else is a bonus.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I agree and disagree with Sue Johnson there. You know, I think once again, if you're looking for someone to fulfill you, you will be not happy.
Yeah, and I often wonder if you will perpetually not find that person until you fulfill yourself. And then it's almost like when you turn back to a place of really cultivating self-love and self-fulfillment and self-satisfaction, there's a radiance. There's like a frequency that emanates from you that is so much less needy and yearning that I feel like that goes out. And this is where I get a little bit woo. And
no,
like that person who truly is going to be like more of that longer term person.
Absolutely. And like attracts like. And, and then there's the part two of this equation where relationships are hard work. People change, they evolve. And you're two human beings. And what does that look like? Like, you know, relationships are work.
No, not like the movies all the time.
No.
But they're awesome, though.
Yes, they are.
And you can actually work with your spouse and rock it.
Yes, we don't sit next to each other. We have very different styles of working.
And it's funny because my wife and I are the same way. Like, we do different things. We work in very different ways, but it just kind of works.
Yep.
So let's go full circle here. So, and I asked you this question 2.5 years ago, but I'm going to ask it again. So the name of this, we're going to do a rigorous comparison now, but the name of this is Good Life Project. So sitting here today, if I offer that term out to you to live a good life, what comes up?
To me, it's having a sense of purpose, meaning, significance. It's this idea of, you know, what I say in the book, you know, it's this idea of wealth. I think it's all the same thing. You know, it's a mental, physical, spiritual, emotional, environmental well-being. I think all these things are, I think that's a good life. You know, I think this idea of wealth is a good life. I think we're in a place where it's more than just the individual. It's our relationships. It's our connection to the universe or spirit or whatever you believe in. It's connection to work. It's connection to your, you know, your tribe. It's a connection to the environment too. It's connection to, you know, we're in a place where everything is interconnected. And I think you can't have one without the other. So I think a true good life is truly interconnected across all these things. That's where I think, you know, in some ways, Oprah and her message of living your best life has evolved, where I think it used to be a very like singular message around, largely around self-help. Self-help's great, but if you're not taking care of your body, if you're not taking care of the environment, if you're not taking care of these things are all interconnected, you know, you're not going to have a quote unquote good life. And I think that's where things have evolved. And that, you know, I think it's a message of Mind, Body, Green. I think it's a message of wealth, and it's how to create that life. You know, this is the book, you know, I say I wish I would have had 20 years ago when I started to go on this journey. So
awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to today's episode. If you found something valuable, entertaining, engaging, or just plain fun, I'd be so appreciative if you take a couple extra seconds and share it. Maybe you want to email it to a friend. Maybe you want to share it around social media. Or even be awesome if you'd head over to iTunes and just give us a rating. Every little bit helps get the word out, and it helps more people get in touch with the message. I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for Good Life Project. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.